Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hi, everybody. I'm Sterling. I'm an alcoholic. I promise I'm going to get that right at least once before I leave here this weekend. It's good to see y'all. It's good to be here. Through God's grace, this program is sponsorship. I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since the 2nd of June, 1981, and for that, I am truly, truly grateful. If you are new to Alcoholics Anonymous and you're wondering why they're applauding, they're not applauding for yours truly, because after I'm done, you'll be convinced that I ain't no big deal. They're applauding because Alcoholics Anonymous has worked in my life for that period of time. And there are several people in this room that it's worked even longer than that. That is miraculous because we are people who normally would not mix. You know, somebody had told me 24 years ago, while I was sitting on that bar stool in northern Japan, that I'd be in a makeshift chapel in the middle of Montana. About to tell people my intimate secrets, I'd have finished that drink. You might have had another speaker here tonight. But I am really grateful to John and Cindy for asking me to come out and helping, advising the committee on asking me to come out. And everybody showed me every courtesy. And then, like I said, it's my first time in Montana. First time. How many people, it's their first time at Beartooth? All right. Cool. All right. Well, I don't know about y'all, but I'm going to have a hell of a time this week. That's what I intend to do. I intend to enjoy myself. There are some friends out here that I haven't seen in a little while. I got a brother Pigeon that's up here that comes here regularly. He shall remain nameless. But if you see us together, you know, have some sympathy for me, okay? And, you know, and some friends that I haven't seen, and I'm looking forward to hearing all the rest of the speakers this weekend. This is going to be a great, great, great weekend. I'm an alcoholic, and if you are an alcoholic, you know what that means. And all I'm going to do is try to, you know, tell you a little bit about what I've come to experience in Alcoholics Anonymous and what I experienced before that. And if it makes sense to you, that's great, and if it doesn't, that's okay too. You know, I have come to understand that there is a wrench for every nut in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I ain't the wrench for you, that's fine, you know. But I'm here because I owe Alcoholics Anonymous. I owe Alcoholics Anonymous my life. Everything that I have that is of any value in my life today can be directly attributed to the program and the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. So when I'm asked to do things for Alcoholics Anonymous, I normally, 99.9% of the time, say yes, unless I have another commitment, because I owe that much. And that still doesn't get me even. Even if I were to do it every day, I'd still be grossly under what I should be giving Alcoholics Anonymous, because there's no way I'd be here breathing in and out. Now, I grew up in New York City, where they make the movies, you know, in the South Bronx, right there, not too far from Yankee Stadium, you know, and I always thought, you know, I'm a weird kid. I was always one of those kids that, you know, just didn't seem to get it, just, you know. If everybody was going this way, I hesitated. I sort of looked that way. You know, that I was one of those kind of kids that needed sponsorship in kindergarten, you know? I'm serious, because I'm a weird person. I think weird. I see weird. I translate stuff through this brain, and it just doesn't come out right, you know? And I was in that room, and everybody else was in that room, and it was two groups as far as I was concerned, me and all of them. You know, and it would have been nice to have been able to make a phone call and ask, what do I do? And that voice would have said, eat the cookie, take the nap. That's all you got to do when you're in kindergarten. I wouldn't have paid any attention, you know, because that's just the way I'm built, you know. But I'm strange. I'm a strange kind of kid. I've always thought different. I'm very self-aware, you know. I'm always thinking about me. I wake up in the morning, what about me, you know. And so I was growing up in this family, you know, and I watched a lot of television when I was a young person. I watched a lot of television that were like family-oriented television, was the Father Knows Best and Bachelor Father, Family Affair, Eight is Enough, Leave it to Beaver, all those shows where you had your typical or somewhat atypical, you know, type of family. And, you know, I grew up in the South Bronx and in the projects, and we didn't have a lawn to mow, you know, and our house wasn't split level or A-framed for that matter. And you can look at me and tell Mom wasn't Donna Reed, okay? So there was no cookies being baked, and Dad was not an engineer. And I always thought that if I had, I felt weird as a kid, and I always thought that if I had had that kind of lifestyle, if I had had that, that Eight is Enough, Leave it to Beaver kind of lifestyle, I'd be better. I wouldn't be so weird. Well, I have been to thousands of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Easily. Thousands. And I have sat right next to people that had Ward Cleaver as a dad. You know, and they're just as screwed up as I am. So it would have made any difference whatsoever what my environment was. It is not because I'm from the South Bronx that I drank. It is not because my parents were a little weird that I drank. It is because I am weird. I suffer from what is characterized in our big book, in the doctor's opinion, of allergy of the body and an obsession of the mind, which means that when I drink, I break out in stuff like wrong places and inappropriate behavior. And I have an obsession of the mind, which tells me that that's okay. You know, it's okay for me to act up, drunk or sober. So that's what I suffer from. That's the disease working in my life. And that disease was working, I think, long before I ever took my first drink, because I felt weird in kindergarten. I felt resentful at home. My full name is Sterling David Holmes III. Now, ain't that something? When you have a Roman numeral at the end of your name, you're supposed to get a country to run. I was waiting for my country. All I got was a little sister that moved into my room. So I got resentments. I haven't even drank yet. Haven't even gotten through grammar school, and already I'm angry, irritable, and discontented. So that means when I took a tall can of Colt 45 on my 13th birthday in the South Bronx, things changed for me. I am grateful to alcohol, because what I had going on up in here was a maelstrom. I was very frustrated and very self-aware and very scared of being found out that I wasn't enough. And if I hadn't found alcohol when I did, I wouldn't have been able to survive on this planet. So I'm grateful that alcohol came into my life when it did. Now, if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I know how important drinking is to you. So much so that even when we say don't do it, you say, nah, I'm going to continue to do it. I understand that. But here's the deal for me. It was real important in the beginning. And when it started to get painful, and when it started to get ugly, and when it started to get to be too much trouble for me, I couldn't put it down. If you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous and you still think that drinking is important to you, that's fine. But if it's causing you problems and pains and difficulties and screwing up your whole life all around you and you won't leave it alone, you might have a problem. And I would suggest you stick around with these people this weekend. Don't drive back down that dirt road, you know. Stick around here and listen to what these people have to say. Whether you believe it or not, believe that they believe it. Because nobody, if they didn't believe it, would come here this weekend, okay? That's the deal, you know? So alcohol was working for me. When I took that tall can of Colt 45 down on the summer's day in the South Bronx, my perception of my life and the life that I had around me changed. I felt like, and I took that drink, I felt like I could speak as well as Jesse Jackson, play sports as well as Reggie Jackson, or dance as well as Michael Jackson. It changed my perception. How I viewed the world was now with power, where I was powerless before. I was always afraid of you finding out the secret. And now that I had this alcohol, I didn't care, because I knew I was cool. I could talk to the girls. I could do everything that I needed to do. Now, I grew up, you know, it was an interesting neighborhood. They had churches and schools, and they had liquor stores in my neighborhood. They also had some gangs, and I wanted to be a part of. I've always been on the outside looking in, and I have a real desire to be a part of something. And gangs looked very appealing in my neighborhood because they had infrastructure and they had support and, you know, and all of that. And I admired that. I liked the way the guys looked out for one another. But the thing was, I was born on this planet with a certain amount of intelligence, I guess, and it was discovered early in school. If they had tested for common sense, they probably would have thrown me out that day. But You know, they said that he's got some sense, and it was, I had that kind of reputation in my neighborhood. None of the gang members who were my friends would allow me to pledge into a gang because they thought that I might have talent enough to get out of that neighborhood. Back in the day, in the early days of gangs, you know, if you had any kind of talent that might have been able to get you out of that neighborhood, those people would not participate in your destruction. You had to do it yourself. You know, and that's the difference between then and now. So I decided I was going to join a big gang, Department of Defense. See, because when they go to a gang fight, somebody going to get hurt. Because they got nuclear weapons. So I decided to join the United States Air Force. And I signed on the dotted line. And when I joined the Air Force, nobody knew that they were getting a young and up-and-coming alcoholic. They didn't have any idea of that. My parents didn't. I didn't. Nobody knew. Now, my mother was a narcotics officer. You know? Yeah, made me real popular in the neighborhood. Real popular. But she didn't recognize alcoholism in her young son. Nobody did. Because at that time, alcoholism to many of the people in my family and many of the people that I ran around with was a bum that laid up against a building with a brown paper bag. I did not look like that. Okay? We might have had exactly the same point of view and we might have had the same emotional structure, might have been exactly the same in every other aspect, but from the outside, he was a bum and an alcoholic, and I was just a troubled young man. And that was the way it went down. And so they thought the Air Force was going to fix me. And the Air Force thought they were going to fix me. And I thought the Air Force was going to fix me. We were all very, very wrong, okay? Because that you can't fix out an inside problem with outside stuff. I was going to learn that the hard way in Alcoholics Anonymous, okay? Because I always want to fix outside stuff. Inside stuff with outside stuff. I mean, a new girl or a new car, some new clothes, you know, that should work. But it don't work. It just maybe for 10 or 15 seconds. Because, you know, no matter how you wrap it, if it's garbage, you know, it's always going to be garbage. You can wrap it up in cute stuff, but it's still going to be garbage. And that was the way I went. I went into the Air Force, and what the Air Force provided me with, and it wasn't their fault, was what was the development that I needed to develop my alcoholism. Because I believe that you need three things, I think, to really do alcoholism right. Yeah, you need three things. You need an income. Doesn't necessarily have to be your income. You need a place to crash, okay? Again, doesn't necessarily have to be your place to crash. And food is important in the beginning, but not that big a deal towards the end. And what the military provided me with was three hots and a cot. So I had alcoholism start to develop quite rapidly because now I had a support system. I was underage drinking in California, doing all kinds of strange things and getting in trouble. You know how we get in trouble. You know, the initial stages, it's like, maybe it was just slightly inappropriate, maybe an off-color joke, maybe, you know, just, you know, passing out where you maybe shouldn't have passed out. And people notice. And they kind of lean on you just a little casually. You know, hey, you really tied one on last night. You know, that kind of thing. And you shine it on. You know, just, oh, yeah, you know. But with us alcoholics, if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, you kind of remember every one of those deals. Whether you get mad at that person or not. And I was remembering them. And I knew that I needed to kind of mellow out a little bit. But I was having too much fun. So again, being a chronically self-centered person, selfish in the extreme, suffering from an allergy of the body and an obsession of the mind, what do I think will solve all of my problems? A relationship. See, because I'm going to find somebody to help me love me. That's what I'm looking for. So I found the object of my obsession, you know, and we lock on. When we, you know, we target acquisition, and when we lock, boop, there we go, right there. And then we're just locked on, and, you know, I just boom, you know. And I have an opinion that there are people out there that come in contact with alcoholics, and they sense the danger, and they run. I also have an opinion that Al-Anons don't run all that fast. It's just a slow trot. Now, there are many people, I love the program of Al-Anon. I have many friends in the program of Al-Anon, and I've come to understand over the years that maybe we ain't doing all the chasing, you know. which is interesting. Very, very interesting. But I found the object of my obsession. And the thing that I'd like to tell you about that is, you know, we don't date. We capture. That's true. But I promised her the world, and I was sincere. I promised that I was going to be a good and loving husband and perhaps father. And I meant that. But the problem is, if you're new, I suffer from alcoholism. You cannot be a good husband and suffer from alcoholism. You cannot be a good father and suffer from alcoholism. You cannot be a good brother, uncle, friend, employee, employer, and suffer from alcoholism, because I have come to understand that this disease is a rapacious creditor, as it says in the 12th. It takes everything. Took my self-respect, took my dignity, took everything that I held most high. It took, because it will take everything, including your sanity and perhaps even your life. And it not only will take what you have, it'll take whatever anybody else has around you. And that's the alcoholism that I suffer from. Now, I didn't learn that in a treatment center, unfortunately. I learned that in sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and more important, watching the people that left the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. See, this disease is serious. And when I married that lady, I was suffering from it seriously, and we had no idea. And we went on our little dance of death. And in a couple, it was about a year. She went overseas. My mother passed away as a result of a tragic accident. And I had to go to the East Coast and bury my mother in 1978. And I had been in service just a couple of a year or so, maybe a year or two. And it was a traumatic experience for me in the sense that I had to go home and try to be a loving son and a loving brother. And I had no capacity for that, because I was drinking and partying and doing things my way. And I came back home selfish and self-centered in the extreme. And I also came back home guilty, because there had been a lot of things I had done to my mom. My mom was a pretty interesting lady. She had lost her Mobile, Alabama accent at Howard University. She was the smartest woman I ever met. Taught me how to read before I got into the first grade. The deal was, I treated her terribly. I was an awful son. Stole from her, insulted her, abused her in every way possible, and blamed her for everything that ever didn't work right in my life. And when she went into the ground, I had no way of being able to make that right. And I don't know how you do guilt. I know how a lot of my friends in this program do guilt. We swallow it and it festers. And it ate me up from the inside out. And you got to drink a lot to fill a hole that's being eaten through with guilt, the shame or the problems or the difficulties. And you know, I don't know about y'all, but when I get into that self-pity trip, I start breaking out that cat of nine tails and I start beating myself with every mistake and every screw up I ever made where she was concerned, and a lot of stuff that didn't even involve either one of us. I start getting into that, and that started the last 2 years of my drinking, and it was insane and crazy and painful and ugly drinking for me. That started it. I went overseas, and, you know, I was stationed in northern Japan. In Japan, they drive on the wrong side of the road. You know, I'd get so drunk sometimes I couldn't remember what side of the road I was supposed to be on. So I'd drive right down the middle. That kind of bizarre behavior worries people. You know, there were times when we used to heat our house with kerosene, and you know, you had to periodically pay for it in cash. They didn't trust us. They didn't believe in credit. You know? And I would drink the kerosene money up, and there would be many times that my daughter and my wife were freezing in the house. I'd come home with a funny joke that I'd heard at the bar, and they didn't think it was all that funny. You know, our timing is awful when we drink, you know. Yeah, and it was bad for me. You know, now the thing is, society knows exactly what to do with people who have bizarre behavior like that. They fix them, because they're frightened of us. You know, I don't know about y'all, but when you're careening down the street, you know, taking all the lanes, people get worried. And they know exactly what to do with folks like that. They put you in a room where there's a little doorknob on the other side, not on your side. And they got a little slat. And they open it up periodically, and they look in on you, you know, and they give you clothes that have long sleeves and a lot of belts. You know, that's what they do with us when we're doing our thing, because they don't understand, and neither do we. So my employer was starting to get a little worried. I mean, there were some times when I would just not show up at work. My attitude was starting to really become poor, and they wanted to help me, But it looked like to me that they were trying to attack me. So I was uncooperative. Now, have you ever been that? Uncooperative? You know? I was uncooperative. And it got down to a point where I always say that the reason why I got to Alcoholics Anonymous is not because I saw the light. I felt the heat, you know? And this was it. They put an ultimatum to me. Either I go down to treatment or they're going to throw me out of the Air Force. And I didn't want to get thrown out of the Air Force. And she was close to getting rid of me, you know, because she had had it. There were times when our young daughter was born, you know, and she'd have need her 3 o'clock bottle. And sometimes Sterling's bottle was more important than my daughter Tanisha's bottle. And I would be trying to give her bottle. And every once in a while, her mother would come into the wonderful scene of seeing her, the father of her child and her husband, who had just dropped his infant daughter because his bottle was more important than her bottle. You know, and those kind of things really kind of tick you off. So she was ready to leave, and the Air Force was ready to put me out. So, of course, you know what I did. I said, okay, for you guys, I'll go to treatment. I don't think I got a problem, but I'll do it to keep you guys quiet. And I went down to the Philippines. Now, I don't know if anybody has been to the Philippines, but down in the Philippines at that time, you could buy a beer for a nickel, American. You could go out on the base, off the base, and explore every demented fantasy you ever had with 10 bucks and come home with change and a few diseases, you know. So it was not a great place to send a young alcoholic, but they sent me there. And in 40-something days, they taught me everything you could possibly learn about alcoholism. You could put in one brain, they did it. I mean, I saw the pictures of Father Martin movie and the Jelly Neck Chart of Recovery and drunkenness, erotic livers. I saw the movie I'll Quit Tomorrow, Days of Wine and Roses. I felt so bad for you alcoholics. I did. Y'all were a sorry lot. I was willing to make a donation. Because y'all had problems. I ain't take none of this personally. I mean, the day before we graduated from alcohol education, that's what the military called it, alcohol education. I'm edumacated about alcohol now. They asked who was most likely to drink 6 months into it. And if I had voted, it would have been unanimous. Because there was 12 of us, 12 angry men, I like to call us. Yeah. There was 12 of us. It would have been a unanimous vote for yours truly. The deal was I had 30-something to 40-something days of sobriety. I came back to this base, and I was on fire, and I was crazy, and I knew I was in trouble, and everybody was watching. And I went to this little room right to the rec center where they had this little circle on it. It had an A on a silver background. It had AA. And I'm being sentenced to Alcoholics Anonymous on this little installation in northern Japan. And I walked in that door. And I don't know if this was your experience. I hope it was, but it was mine. When I walked in that door, I saw people smiling from ear to ear. Hi, how you doing? My name is so-and-so. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. We're going to start the meeting in a few minutes. Want a cup of coffee? Here, have a seat. Everything. Woo! And it pissed me off. How dare you feel that way about me when I don't feel that way about me? They were so glad to see me. I know why now. But it baffled me then. Why are you so happy to see me? Because they were bouncing around the room and they started the meeting and they were just happy and everything was great. And I'm sitting there kind of perplexed. I'm looking around the room and I'm seeing these things on the wall, these little slogans. And I'm looking around, first things first. That's deep. Easy does it. Okay, they stole that from Nike. All right. You know, I'm just wondering what all these things are, and I see this picture, these two old white guys. I'm looking at these pictures, and there's another painting of a guy sitting on the bed with these two white guys talking to him. I'm just, what is? I don't know what all this is. And you know, I just kind of kept, I was sitting there watching, and you started talking about yourselves. And you was telling some terrible stuff about, and you would laugh? My goodness. I mean, you know, the guys, I woke up naked on my front lawn. You know? And everybody else is laughing. I'm thinking about, you shouldn't be telling people this. I was embarrassed for you. You know? And you started talking about this stuff, and I'm thinking now, you know, some of it I'm relating to, and I'm going, I wonder if my wife called them. You know? But the thing you did that really clinched it, that made me, you know, very curious about you, was you started with a prayer, you ended with a prayer, and you passed the basket. Now that I recognized. Aha. I know what you guys are. You guys are a cult. Y'all gonna try to jump me to Jesus. Or make me shave my head and sell books at that damn airport. I know that. That's what y'all are about. I got it now. See, because I knew all about religion. In my travels, prior to getting into the military, I had done a lot to try to find the perfect religion that would allow me to be a complete jerk and still get into heaven. I had grown up a Catholic and had been to Catholic as a result of Catholic education through the through my first year of college. I had left Catholicism well before I ever got through high school and was, at one time, a practicing Muslim. You know, I was looking for anything. There was a time in my underwear with a 36 bottle of Colt 45. I had an argument with a Jehovah's Witness and I won. She left. You know, that's the deal. I knew all about God. I had the book, had the Quran, had both versions of the Bible. I had been doing the whole deal. There was one time there was a young lady that I knew. I wanted what she had and I was willing to go to any lengths to get it. And she was in this choir. So I joined the Baptist choir. And at the time, the Baptist choir was a young adult choir. This Methodist church needed a young adult choir, couldn't get one together, so they loaned us to the Methodist church. So at any given Sunday, I was a failed Catholic who was a practicing Muslim singing in a Baptist choir in a Methodist church. So by the time I got to you, I knew everything there was to know about God. And y'all started with a prayer and ended with a prayer and passed the basket. And it had not been for you sharing your experience, strength, and hope with me, had it not been for the light I saw in your eyes, had it not been for the way you made me feel when I was with you, I would have walked out the door. Because it had just been one of those other places I would have failed at. That's what I would have thought. But you did those things. You talked to me. You smiled at me. You shook my hand. There was a guy in my home group, George. George about 6'3", 6'4". Tall, Navy guy, big beard. He liked hugging people. Now, I'm from New York. You another man. You ain't hugging me. George would chase me around a little room to hug me. One day, he caught me. And I got hugged. And I started liking the hug. I started coming to meetings just for the hugs. Now, I was thinking maybe 6 months sober, I might be gay. Now, newcomers, I'm talking to you. If you ever get a crazy thought in your mind, share that thought with somebody that's been here longer than you. You know, an old timer, they ain't got nothing to do. You know, just talk to them about it. Because they'll start asking you questions, and as a result of getting those questions answered, you know, you'll come to understand that that was just a crazy thought. Because the question would be, I think I'm gay. Okay, do you like girls? Yeah. Okay, are you married? Yeah. You're not gay. Oh, okay. And then you can move on, you know? But if you spend time thinking about it, what's going to happen, you know, with me, I'd have divorced my wife and bought a dress and left the, you know? Because I'm stuck. I don't know if you think like that, but I think like that. Once I get a thought in my head, if I don't get rid of it, either through doing something or saying, talking about it, it's going to stay up there and it's going to just drive me nuts. And that was the way it was. That first year I was sober, I was on fire. They just loved me, you know. And you got to be careful when you love a newcomer, you know, because you make them too special, they get in a lot of trouble. But those people gave me a lot of love. There was a lady, Kathy, who I used to call at 3 o'clock in the morning. That was my suicide hour. I don't know when your suicide hour is, but 3 o'clock in the morning is when I start thinking about the rope or the river. And I would call Kathy up at 3 in the morning, you know, and all this stuff. And she never was mean to me. She would always just try to talk me through it. And she says, well, what we'll do is tomorrow when I see you at the meeting, we'll talk about it later. Okay, Sterling? Okay. You know, and I'd hang up the phone. And you know, now I sponsor a lot of guys. And I'm on hotline at my home group. And I gotten woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning. And out of what I owe Kathy, I'm not all that quick to tell you what time it is. Because I owe that lady. I owe George. I owe my first sponsor, even though he didn't know it. He was my first sponsor because he was 5 years sober and he dumped that big book and he quit smoking and he lost 50 pounds and he was on fire about Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was the only meeting on the base and there wasn't another one for 50 miles. So I didn't do 90 and 90, but we met 3 times a week and my butt was dead 3 times a week. And the deal was, those people loved me. And I was in love with Alcoholics Anonymous as a direct result of participating and being given something for free that is very, very valuable. If you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, what we are giving you for free is very valuable to us. So when you see the enthusiasm coming out of us, when you see us get all worked up about it, it's because we really get off on this. This is important to us. A lot of us wouldn't be breathing if we didn't have it. So that's why we do it. We're not trying to sell you. We don't get stipends for how many people we convert. Those people were on fire to give me the message of Alcoholics Anonymous because they hadn't had a newcomer stick around for a while. And they were giving it away, Jack, because they were trying to save their own butts. And that's the deal. That's what I had to learn. They made me coffee maker. I make awful coffee for 2 weeks. I would get there an hour early for a 25-minute commitment. I would put, like, you know, get those big tureens, and I would think there were 16, 17 people coming to the meeting, 16, 17 little yellow caps. I was making Starbucks is what I was doing. I was the first back in the 80s. And I tell you, they drank it. We used a lot of cream, and when we got that circle, they said, they asked for a volunteer. 3-4 people volunteered to be coffee makers, but they said, thank you, Sterling. Keep coming back, They made me chairperson because I thought it was because I was so eloquent. No, they knew I was nuts. So they would put me at the front of the room because they knew my ego would not allow me to walk right past everybody and go out that door. So I would have to sit in the front and come up with topics. And I would come up with sick topics. And they would spend the rest of the meeting 12-stepping me. So that's one of the reasons why I never give up a service gig. Not because I get off on being in the front or in the whatever. No, I get because I'm in need. I'm in desperate need of being involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. Otherwise, I'm going to drift away. And I may never come back. And y'all will be fine. But I never want this to precede my name. Whatever happened to, because we know, every one of us knows of whatever happened to. And I don't want to be that person. After a year of dealing with those folks, and I was in love with Alcoholics Anonymous, I came back to the United States. I was on fire about being in AA. Only one small, a couple of small problems with AA. Because, the first year, you figure out all the things that are wrong with AA. I knew that there was a shortage of African Americans in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I was going to take it upon myself to get thousands of black people in AA. Because I wanted another picture up on that wall. By this time, I figured out these two guys were in charge, and I wanted another, I was going to make a movie of the week out of it, the next generation kind of thing. That's what I was thinking, I got back to Washington, D.C., and it was a meeting on the southeast side. It was sort of like an Alano club, and there were, seemed like thousands of black people in AA out there. Many of them sober longer than me, which pissed me off, But I got involved, and there's a lady in my home group that a lot of people here know. And she always says, meeting makers make it. And I went to meetings. I went to meetings maybe for all the wrong reasons, but I went to meetings. No matter what, I went to meetings. And as a result of going to meetings, I would like to say that the first 5 years of my sobriety was stellar, but as a result of going to meetings, the first 5 years of my sobriety, I didn't drink. I didn't have a sponsor. I had only gotten up to about step 5, but I didn't drink. And by the time I got 5 years sober, I was crazy because I hated you, I hated me, I hated it, I hated them, didn't hate God yet, but I was crazy. And I knew that I would either have to get a sponsor or kill myself. Equally tragic decisions as far as I was concerned. I figured I'd go for the more temporary of the two. I'll get a sponsor now, I'll kill myself later if it doesn't work out. And that's when my God, with his sense of humor, sent me to Omaha, Nebraska, which does not sound like AA Mecca. But it was for me, because when I walked into that meeting that I went to on a Tuesday night called the Fox Hall Group, what happened was I encountered the same thing I had encountered 5 years earlier. People smiling from ear to ear. Hi, how you doing? My name is so-and-so. Listen, we're about to start the meeting. We want a cup of coffee? You're there. Woo! Okay, that was my experience. They were sober. I was sober. Now, which do you prefer? You know, I wanted to have fun. I wanted to have, but I didn't know that I needed to have structure in order for that to happen. These people had something going for them. They had the light in the eyes. They had the ease and comfort that I was looking for. And what I did was I asked a man there to sponsor me. Now, I had been to a lot of discussion meetings by this time. And I was of the opinion that the person who was helping was getting more help than the person who was actually getting the help. You know, that's what I heard in a discussion meeting one time. You know, when we sponsor people, sometimes we benefit more than they do, you know. And so I was thinking that if I asked this guy to sponsor me, he would be so appreciative, you know, because the selection process had taken 5 years, you know. I mean, come on. So, and I asked him, and he made me say please. That pissed me off. But the thing was, he kind of gave me a resentment. He made a meeting schedule, and he circled meetings in the meeting schedule, and he said, if you don't want to hide in Alcoholics Anonymous, you'll go to these meetings. Now I was 5 years sober, you know, and I took his inventory that day. I took his inventory the next day. I took his inventory the day after. Now, I'm going to tell you, if you knew, if you'd taken somebody's inventory for 3 straight days, they the same sex as you, get them for a sponsor. Because if they're going to spend that much time up in your head, at least they can clean some stuff up while they're up there. I asked him, and he said yes. I said please, and he said yes, and he gave me some rules. And one of them was to attend this meeting dressed like this. Now, I had worn ties throughout most of my Catholic school education. I'd worn ties in the military. I had worn ties when I was running the streets in New York. I'd wore a tie to a whorehouse, okay? And the deal was, when he told me I had to wear a tie every Tuesday night, you thought he'd asked me to take another rib from my chest or something. Because I was every Tuesday night putting on this tie, on these AA Nazis. I don't know what the heck is wrong with these people. I'd get in the car and I'd go, I'm going to fire him. I don't need these big book thumping sons of guns making me do all this stuff. I'd get down the stairs of the meeting and I'd shake a few hands and they'd go, I'm going to fire him. These people are crazy. They're just singing happy birthday and giving cakes to people and sponsorship. Who ever heard of this crap? I mean, I'm going to go to the meetings where everybody's pissed off, where AA's supposed to be. I'd sit down, and by the time they finished reading How It Works, I was in love with everybody in the room. And over the years, I got to learn their stories and learn their names, and I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous, and I learned how to be a structured and principled person in the program, because my sponsor would not allow me to get away with anything. You know, and he put it to me. If I wanted to change my life, I was going to have to do something. It wasn't going to happen by osmosis. It wasn't going to be a magical little fairy dust was going to fall on me during, you know, we were doing a tradition study and all of a sudden, bing, you know, Sterling Serene, you know, I mean, it wasn't going to happen that way. I was going to have to work my butt off. I was going to have to be where I said I was going to be and do what I said I was going to do. He would force me to grow up. And there were some times when I thought this man had to be out of his mind. Because I would call him and tell him a problem, and he would give me a solution that to me did not sound like it was going to address this problem. I would call him up taking her inventory, you know, her inventory, which I thought I had the right to take. And I'd say, well, Reggie, this is what you're saying. And this is what she means. And this is what I think I ought to do. And yada, yada, I think she's suffering from depression. That's what I think. I really do. I think that's what she's doing. And he'd go mow the lawn. And I go, is this the right, is this Reggie, you know, I mean, you know, is this Reggie, did I hear you right? Go mow the lawn. I'd hang up the phone and I'd go, this man's crazy. I'd go mow the lawn. See, Reggie knew I had allergies. And when fresh cut grass gives me allergies. And I'd get so, you know, allergic that all I could do is take an aspirin and go lay down. I wouldn't fight. He taught me how to be a man in my own house by washing the dishes, taking out the garbage, saying good morning, please, and thank you. Things that I would give, common courtesies I would give to anybody out there, but had forgotten how to do with the people that I really cared about. Because that's my nature. I take a lot of stuff for granted. I'm self-centered. And what he was addressing was my self-centeredness. He took me through the rest of the steps, which was necessary in order for me to stay here, or else I wouldn't have been around you all. I wouldn't have felt like I was a part of. And I remember when we did my fifth with him, I was very worried about some of the stuff that I had shared, because a lot of that was in sobriety. I had gotten rid of the drunk stuff with a priest, but the sobriety stuff was the stuff I felt most ashamed of. And I shared that with him, and that was on a Sunday, and I had to work in the military. I was still in the service. That Friday night, I went to a meeting, and my sponsor extended his hand to me. And that was the first time I can honestly say I felt completely welcomed in Alcoholics Anonymous. My stuff was out in the street, and nobody made any judgments, particularly the one man that I was putting my trust in. And that was the turning point in how I lived my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember there were times on Tuesday night, my little girl, that little baby that I dropped, was still with me, and she would say, "Daddy, I want you to come play with me. Why, you know, can you not go to the meeting tonight? Just stay home and play with me." And I would kiss her on the forehead, and I would leave that house banging that steering wheel, pissed off, because I knew that if I stayed and played with her, I'd lose whatever I was getting from here, and I would lose her as a result. So I left on those Tuesday nights because I needed to be in the place where I knew I could get it. Now, there were other meetings I attended. I was a meeting maker, but I knew on Tuesday nights, sitting among those people that I had learned to love, I'd get it. And it's real necessary that I keep getting it, because in order to give it away, I got to have it. And I lose it. I don't know about y'all, but I wake up in the morning, it's gone. You know, I mean, give me an ATM machine and a resentment, I could be gone from here, you know. I ain't that far from Canada. You know, boom, I'm out of here, you know. So I need to keep getting it. And I kept going. And, you know, as with sobriety, life happens in sobriety. Life always happens in sobriety. I remember climbing the stairs one night, one evening, and asking my wife, "Do you want to remain married to me?" And she said, "Nope." Never ask a question you're not prepared for the answer. So we ended up getting a divorce, and I felt like I was humiliated. Humiliated. I felt like a complete failure. I was 9.5 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm supposed to be getting the AA brass ring. Now I'm coming up on double-digit sobriety, Jack. I'm a holy man. And I'm ended up with a divorce now, a failure as a husband and as a father. I was crushed. And my sponsor, the kind, loving man that he is, put his arm around me and said, "You know, we're really blessed to have the only man ever to get a divorce in Alcoholics Anonymous." See, these are not nice people you're dealing with. These are honest people you're dealing with. You know, and he was telling me the truth, that room was chock full of people who had gone through just as tough times. I mean, they had lost family members. They had lost friends. They had come, you know, to grips with poverty the way they had never remembered it to be before. And they were still doing the deal, putting their phone number on a piece of paper, handing it to a newcomer, showing up at their service commitments, making the cake. You ever had a resentment? You got to make the cake for the meeting. That's a tough cake to make, Jack, even if it's only going to the grocery store and paying for it. It's just a tough deal. I had to go through all that, and so did they. And they were sitting in them rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they have continued to be an example to me. When I walk into my home group, I know some of the people in there are having a tough day. I know that. And there they are. And they're forcing the smile. And they're walking up to people who are new. And they're telling them this thing works. They ain't lying. It does. Because they're there, standing right in front of them. You know, I can see the power of God happening in my home group. When I know that there's stuff going on, people are suffering, and they're still doing this deal, living by these principles to the best of their ability. Man, that's invigorating. That's inspiring. And it's humbling. Because when my problems are my problems, they're my problems. You know, and I think they're most important. I got through that. Taking an inventory, I got through that divorce. And my God, with a sense of humor, sent me another relationship with a lovely woman that I'm still married to today. And the deal is, I had to be the man that I was taught to be here in order to be the kind of husband that I am now. You know, I'm not too bad. The Al-Anons will report on me later, I know, but that's okay. I need a written copy. That's all. I just asked for a written copy. You know, so we went through our deal. I mean, I've gone through disappointments in the military. I've gone through all of that. And what has happened is, I've remained a grown-up. That little girl that I dropped several times and walked out on to go to meetings was still in my life. My sponsor would not allow me to be just a checkbook dad. My sponsor forced me to maintain contact with her and to be encouraging and to be, you know, all of the things that I need to be over the phone. And on our high school graduation, I was there. On our grammar school graduation, I was there. On our college graduation, I was there. And she's going to get married in about 6 weeks to this young man. I'm trying to change. And I'll be there. And the reason why is because of you, because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember when she was going through high school, she got her National Merit Scholarship in Washington, D.C., George Washington High School, Duke Ellington High School, not George Washington High School. It's in the George Washington, in the Howard University area, George Washington area. And she got the chance to give her little valedictorian speech. And she, in front of all those people, she thanked her dad for his kindness and his encouragement. Now, y'all know me. I'm self-centered in the extreme. I'd lie as soon as look at you. I might even steal your wallet. And my daughter, in front of all those people, to include Eleanor Holmes Norton, the U.S. District Representative from the District of Columbia, in front of Marion Barry and all those other people, she thanked her father for his kindness and his encouragement. Now, that is a testament to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, the things that you see these people walking around with don't belong to them. They belong to the collective people that have given them kindness, that have worked them over in coffee shops until 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. It belongs to everybody who made them fill out the pad from one end to the other, made them sit down and read the book instead of talking about the book. You know, that's what all those things belong, and it belongs to a loving God that gave them that stuff even though they didn't deserve it. So when you think they're walking around here on an ego trip, the reality is that Alcoholics Anonymous has given them everything that has gotten their shoulders square and they're keeping them standing up and upright and clear-eyed and happy, joyous, and free. That's what you're seeing. The rest of it is just us. And that's what hopefully you'll relate to. And the two of them together will take you to places that you will never believe possible. That was the experience for me. When that little girl graduated from college, she came down the stairs after getting an honors in psychology and women's studies, but I'm not bragging. She came down those stairs and she looked at me in the eyes and with those little brown eyes that she did when she was a little one, and she said, "Did I do good, Daddy?" You know, I'm a part of her life as a direct result of you being a part of mine. I have a wonderful wife, and she has two children, one of whom has given us four grandchildren. And I'm pawpaw to them. The oldest one is 13, the youngest one is 3, and they come in, they raid my refrigerator, they hug me, and they leave. And I love it. And I love it. And I love them. My wife's son was living with us. When I retired out of the Air Force, I came back to Omaha to live, and he was like 13, 14 years old. And he liked rap music. Liked rap music. Loved rap music. You know, and I was not a big proponent of rap music at that time. I ended up having an accident. I broke my ankle, and I was home on disability for 3 months. And we did a 3-month symposium on rap music. Thank you very much. But because of you, I learned how to be patient and understanding. I learned how to be responsible. I learned how to tell the truth, even when it made me uncomfortable, even when it frightened me. And as a result, that young man who's in his 20s now can still come to me and feels like he can talk to me. I'm glad. I'm proud. I'm thankful for that, because this young man might not have been in my life had it not been for you. I've done a lot of different jobs. I'm about to switch jobs again in sobriety. I've done a lot of different jobs, and you taught me that I was supposed to kind of get there early and I was supposed to leave late, that I was supposed to give an honest day's work for an honest day's pay. And I've had certain amount of successes as a direct result of that. I've had certain disappointments. But there are a lot of people in my job today that I don't like. And what is a testament to you, they don't know it. They have no earthly idea. My sponsors heard me call them everything but a child of God every once in a while. But they don't know it, because you taught me how to take actions towards people I don't like. You taught me how to be spiritual and be a principled person day in and day out. When I decided to make the grand announcement that I quit smoking, my sponsor told me, he said, "Don't tell anybody." And I said, "Why not?" He says, "Because I'm not going to allow you to be an asshole just because you quit smoking. You're going to have to be a loving member of this program. You're going to have to be a consistent dad, a sponsor. You're going to have to be a good employee. And if I see you getting squirrely, I'm going to tell you to have a smoke, because I'd rather see you have a smoke than to have a beer." And you know, after about 6 weeks of doing that, I didn't care if anybody knew or not. I haven't had a cigarette in a long, long, long time. And that's a testament to what I've been shown, what I've been given, what's been shared with me. I'm not the guy. I'm one beggar telling you where the bread's at. And I'm eating my butt off because I believe strongly in staying in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's safe there. There are a lot of nutcases in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I need to talk to them and share them and bore the living daylights out of them with my experience, strength, and hope, because that's what's going to keep my butt in the seat. You know, the deal is, the most wonderful thing that can ever happen to you in Alcoholics Anonymous is if when you're in the room and somebody's talking and you're listening to them and you do this, you just got it. If you're ever in a room and somebody like me is talking and you do this, guess what? You're an alcoholic. Because only alcoholics do this when alcoholics are talking. Al-Anons do this. I love the comment between the difference between the programs is anybody can get in AA, but you got to know somebody to get in Al-Anon. That is very, very true. I am grateful to both of those programs because my wife has a sponsor and I have a sponsor, and they ain't each other. And we have a great life in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm grateful for that. I'm telling you, if you're old in Alcoholics Anonymous, I know from times to times the fear kicks in and you stop growing and things get tough and you don't want to do this deal. And if you ever have to chair another meeting when you're not feeling well, you think you'll scream and all of that. I know how that happens. I know I've had that happen to me. But I beg you, if you got any kind of time in Alcoholics Anonymous, go find somebody that you can sit down with and get them to do this. Because that's where the real magic is in Alcoholics Anonymous. Looking somebody in the eye and they go, yeah, yeah, yeah. Being there when they go, what do I do? That's when the real magic of Alcoholics Anonymous happens. That's when what has been given to us freely for the last 70 years takes hold, takes root, and has no danger whatsoever of ever going away. If we remember that what we're supposed to do is one-to-one, meet in groups, travel in pairs, that kind of thing. We trust God, clean house, help others. Ain't no way any of the stuff that we worry about messing us up is going to mess us up, because only Alcoholics Anonymous can only be destroyed from within Alcoholics Anonymous. And as long as we put God first and our own needs second, ain't no way it's going to happen. Ain't no way it's going to happen, because there's going to be hundreds of people coming in the door with problems. Some of them we can help with, some of them maybe we can't. But what we're supposed to do is share our experience, strength, and hope as enthusiastically and as consistently as we possibly can, because it's important, it's valuable, it's wonderful, it's an expression of God's love for us. And I don't know of anything that is as close to divinity as love is, because it's limitless, it knows no respecter of persons, it's everywhere, it's all the time, it's perfect. And we have tapped into love, hope, and tolerance here. And we need to practice it, because that's the thing that turns the head. That's the thing that draws them in. That's the thing that carries our message. That is the ship we put our whole deal on. And that's the responsibility of me, because I've been around here a little while and seen how it's supposed to have been done. I would recommend strongly that you find some crusty old timer and go on a 12-step call. Ain't nothing like a rip-roaring, rim-snucking 12-step call. I just love them, boy, when you got the house and you got the kids and you got him and they ain't doing nothing and I don't want to go to no meeting and y'all can take that book and shove it. I like that. Because when I walk out of there, I'm grateful. I'm grateful as hell. I'm grateful for what God has given me that I didn't deserve. I'm grateful that y'all put up with me. I'm grateful that Alcoholics Anonymous is big enough to allow me to hang out in it. I'm grateful that God is magnanimous enough to give me the gifts that he's given me, because I do not deserve them. I'm grateful that he's given me friends and family. I'm grateful that he's given me challenges, failures, and successes. I'm grateful that he's given me life. And I didn't get on the planet that way. Y'all done changed me without my permission. You know, and I thank you for it. I'll close with a story. Guy was trying to paint his house. He had a 2-year-old helping him. He always has a 2-year-old. You know, 2-year-olds are never any help. If you have any 2-year-olds now, they no help. So he found a picture of all the continents, the oceans, and everything like that, tore it up into pieces, said, go in the room, put this puzzle together, thinking that he'd have some time. 3-4 minutes, the little child comes out, finished. What? How did you do that? Wait a minute. There's some places I'm not sure where it was supposed to go. What? How did you do that? There was a man on the other side. Put the man together, the world comes together. I came in Alcoholics Anonymous with a lot of problems, issues, difficulties, you know, deals. I had a lot of stuff going on in this head. And y'all told me that, yeah, well, that's very compelling, Sterling. Let's set all that for aside. Let's give you a God that loves you unconditionally. Let's provide you with a place where you can practice trying to live one day at a time with spiritual principles on a regular basis and not get laughed at. Let's give you steps, traditions, concepts. Let's give you some things to do. And armed with that, let's see then if you can go out and tackle those problems. Now, I defy anybody to try it the way I've tried it. If you can, as it's been quoted in the book in Dr. Bob's Nightmare, if you can bring to it any of the enthusiasm you have for destroying your life, you will be amazed at the results that will take place. And if they don't, call me up and call me a liar. I'm grateful to be here and sober. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.